guys, welcome to episode 34 of Caster Calls with Zombie Grub. Today I have a Rainbow Six and a recent Valorant commentator, actually. That is Jess Goats. So I don't know, should I call you Jess Goat? Is that your full name? Or should I call you Jess? Or...
It's mostly my brand name. I just go by Jess. There's another Jess in the Siege community. So I guess for more specific purposes, if you want to find me on social media, it's just Jess Goat. But otherwise, Jess is cool.
Okay, yeah, that'll work for me. See, my name is also Jessica, and I also prefer to go by Jess.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, my sister-in-law is also named Jessica, so that's made some a lot of confusion. But, you know, it's a very popular name for 90s kids, mm-hmm. I think.
But that's the truth.
Yeah, so do you feel weird calling other Jessicas Jessica?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, like if there was another Jessica that was like, yeah, call me Jessica, I'd be like, but why? Why? Why not just Jess?
Yeah, exactly. I love that name so much more. Yeah, you can call me ZG if that wasn't clear. That's fine. That's kind of what I prefer to go on by anyways. But yeah, so you've been so busy, and I've already thanked you before the podcast, but just thank you again on the podcast for actually making some time and coming out to talk about your career path getting into esports. It sounds like it's going to be an interesting one, as well as your actual work in esports, because you seem to really be putting in a lot of hours and really thinking critically about this this whole field. So that's what I'm excited about talking about. I hope you are as well. And generally, we just kind of get into your backgrounds and then work from there. So how did you get into esports?
Oh, I guess long story short, I was playing low-level competitive Call of Duty back on the console days when, you know, all of the comp was on console, and I was playing pretty heavily during my bachelor degree. I would say that if I wasn't studying and at the university, I was playing Call of Duty to the point where I can't remember the hours I had clocked, but I remember making it to Prestige Master 860, which is a huge level count to get, and it was something that, you know, only hackers had that high of a level, and I was like, ha, suck it, I got there, you know, through these hours, and I was loving it. And at that time, you had to like run like a website to do pickup games or paid games or competitive games. So you'd have to go on the website, log in to like verse each other, put your gamer tag in, and then you go back to the console, add each other, then you go into the lobby, and then you do the, and it was just, it was this long-winded process, but I loved it. I loved it. I lived for it. I was a huge search and destroy player. I was the sniper for my team. I loved everything about it. And then, speaking of my team decided that one day they would move to another game. It's the dreaded discussion where your teammates go, I'm moving to a brand new game. And you think to yourself, how could there be a better game than Call of Duty in the world right now? This is not possible. And they go, please go buy Rainbow Six. We're moving to this game. And I was like, this is incredible. And mind you, I was a poor little university student living on my own, living on noodles every day, trying to afford rent and food. And they're like, go buy Rainbow Six. Like, sure, buddy, you're going to go buy it for me. So I did shoo-in it for about 2 weeks, and I missed my teammates very dearly. So I said, I'm going to go get it. I played it for maybe 3 days, and I already thought I was addicted to Call of Duty. And then Siege, it just blew it out of the water. The tactical prowess of that game, I mean, sheesh. I tell you what, there is not a game that has a higher skill ceiling in FPS domain than Siege does. So I was hooked from that moment onwards. Played comp for years. First woman to qualify for Challenger League in Australia. That's a semi-professional league. Then, unfortunately, I was in my master's. I was teaching at a university, and my team, they had to break it to me that I didn't have enough hours in the day to scrim. So I had to move to sub, you know, going from captain to sub, quite a demotion there. But, you know, I put my hands up and said for the betterment of the team. And then I got picked up as a professional coach and shipped over to Germany. So that's where I started my professional analyst and coaching career, straight from player, finished my master's degree, moved over to Germany for Penta. And then I did that and lots of other stuff. That's a very long-winded story. I was going to say TLDR, but it really wasn't.
Trust me, it's actually one of the shorter introductions. Okay, cool. So you're absolutely good. So what year was that you got picked up to be a coach?
2018 was when I was announced to join Penta, and that's when I had to move over, yeah.
Okay, and that was while you were doing your master's, or...?
I just finished my master's when I had to move.
Okay.
And I I remember it being such a tricky situation because I hadn't got my master's degree yet because they had one graduation ceremony a year and I had just missed it by putting in my last little bit of thesis. And so you have to wait until the graduation ceremony comes to get your certificate, like your full-blown certificate, like a half-baked one before your actual full, you know, what's okay. it called? Diploma? Whatever it's called, certificate? Yeah, like whatever they call the certificate thing. I don't really care. I don't go to any of my graduations. I don't care. But you, in order for me to move over to Germany and get my visa, you had to prove that you had those skills. And to prove, it needs to have that big seal, a little shiny thing on it, and it's a seal of approval. And I was like, how am I going to get this? So I argue with my university for ages. They ended up sending me one. Then we got it express shipped overseas. I ended up getting a visa in the end, but it was such a nightmare. I'll tell you this much. Visas for an Australian woman all across the world, you would think that we're from Antarctica with that kind of nonsense.
Hmm. I feel like I've heard similar sentiments from Australians that it's incredibly difficult to go overseas kind of in general. As an American, I guess I am somewhat conscious of the fact that Americans actually, like, our passport's actually pretty damn good and, like, people tend to accept us, well, this year notwithstanding, but that's a interesting hiccup there. I mean, I did graduate from college. I didn't get a master's or anything, but I mean, if you weren't able to attend the graduation ceremony, they were just like, all right, it's in the mail anyways. Like, we didn't want you anyways. Well,
that's the thing, is that I would have thought that once you completed and you showed all your credits were done and everything was submitted, your passed and yada yada, that it just becomes automatic. But they do an online version, right? Like, you're finished, there's your online version. But to get the legitimate one, you have to wait until the next scheduled graduation ceremony. And if your university only does that once a year, mind you, this is Australia, so it's not like we're rigid dig American colleges and shit like that, you know what I mean? But then you have to wait until it. And I think that was like March or something like that. So honestly, I was sitting there like technically masterless for ages. And I was like, okay, what do I do visa-wise with this? But it was okay. I took like, you get 3 months holiday in Schengen areas. So I got to use the 90 days, which was okay. Lived in Zurich for a little bit and then moved over to Germany and was full-time there.
Okay, cool. So I'm kind of like missing something though. Like, why did you need the master's degree? What did it prove to go to Germany?
So you can have a skilled work visa because esports is not quite as known. And it actually leads into another story of me working in Italy and not getting a visa because they don't recognize esports as being a career. So it doesn't fit under the work visa. But to get a visa easier, you can show both your bachelor and master's degree or a certain level of education, get either an EU blue card, which is like my understanding of a green card in the US or something like that, like the easiest move around all of the EU if you have a master's degree, which is really cool. I didn't know that originally. So if you show them that, but then you have to be paid a certain amount per month. So there's so many rules involved into how these visas work that it's, I did get a pay rise as a result. That was a good one. I enjoyed that. So, but taxes in Germany are unbelievable. So you didn't really get the pay rise in the end.
Yeah, I've heard that about European countries. Mm-hmm. I've heard of such things like skilled workers, but I always figured that the process had to be a lot more like streamlined to what you were like actively involved in, you know?
I thought so too.
But apparently it's just like you're skilled at anything, so you're skilled at everything. So
there you go. and be a mental coach then or whatever. And I'm like, okay.
That's good info for the future, maybe.
Exactly.
But anyway, so moving on. So you become a coach right after being, you know, a semi-pro, would you say? Or professional full-time?
Barely. Okay. Semi-pro, let's be honest. Yeah, in the Australian scene, yeah.
Yeah, that's always difficult. But I mean, you were kind of emerging. You said 2018, so you're kind of emerging at the, you know, one of those esport members that's coming in a bit later than some other people I've talked to on this podcast. And you know, by that point, there were a lot of countries that were certainly recognizing that esports was a thing, and that Australia was less of just an island in the middle of nowhere. Although that's still ultimately what it is. So I feel like maybe like you came in like at a bit of a better time where there is a little more recognition for the Australian scene. Of course, I can't say that about Rainbow Six. I'm just talking about general esports. So I think it still actually holds some weight. If you had told me that, you know, in 1999, Yorisa might probably be like, oh, all right.
I mean, anyone who picked up, you know, controller at that point, I'm sure in FPS would have been absolutely raging through anyone. But yeah, I do get that. Unfortunately, the Rainbow Six Siege scene is underdeveloped in APAC South as a whole. So I think, like, we've always been, like, we didn't even have our stats registered until Season 7. And that was the season I actually qualified for Challenger League. So I have it listed in my Liquipedia as like, yo, she was an ex-semi-professional player. Had I qualified a season before, nothing would show up. That thing doesn't exist. That never existed officially. So, yeah, lucky, kind of, I guess.
It's, yeah, definitely an emerging at the right time, exact right time. Yeah. So then coach, which you, you did for a couple of years then, and then when did you transition into more of a commentary role?
During my coaching career, I made it a really big point that if I was going to live in Europe, I was going to take advantage of everything that the European esports scene offered. And I did cop a lot of criticism, actually, that I was one of the coaches that was also focusing on my brand. And I don't think people understood that you could, yes, sacrificing sleep and social life. And I barely speak a lot of German to begin with. So it, I didn't have a huge social life in Germany to begin with. I spent most of it in the office. If you were like me and you like put all of your hours into work and then working on your brand, which for me was live streaming on Twitch, and then on Twitter and a couple other social media mediums, then you could really make a name for yourself beyond just being a coach and an analyst. So I said to myself, fine, I'm going to make sure I make a name for myself. I segregated my name from the organizational name because I knew it wasn't going to be permanent. And I came up with Jess Goad and things started to roll along. And then I started to put my hand up for analyst desks because at the time I had already had public speaking experience, being, you know, teaching at universities. I ran my own teaching business during my bachelor degree, you know, for students in tuition centers. So I was confident in speaking. I wasn't confident in casting. I'd done some casts, but nothing high enough that you're really confident. And then I said to yourself, I'm like, well, I don't mean to be rude, but like you have no chicks anywhere in the world for any of your talent. Like that seems a little like, you know, I hate to say it, and I hope I can say it on this podcast, it's a bit of a sausage fest. So I was sort of like, I made a joke on Twitter about it, which I copped flack for, but anytime a woman stands up for anything about diversity, you're gonna expect to cop flack, so go figure. And I sort of said it, and I said, get me on the desk. And fly me over, get me on the desk for the UKIN finals. I think it was UKIN spring finals. They contacted me instantly. They said, let's fly you over, let's do it. I did it. I would say I wasn't horrible, but I wasn't great. I definitely learned a lot about a live environment, how you can better deal with the camera and so on and so forth. And yeah, that was my first spring shot into the analyst talent life. Then I went, did the Benelux finals. I did a few things here and there during my coaching career. And I really think that gave me a solid foundation as a talent to then start focusing on casting women's CSGO. I started to work on that quite a bit. Traveled around Europe for that. I still do it. My last gig was just before the pandemic. I flew to Dubai to cast the women's Gamer Girl Fest grand finals for CSGO. I love CSGO. And then, yeah, I've just started casting whatever qualifies for Siege I could, you know? So that's how you learn, I think, is that you can't just go, well, I'm coaching, I can't do anything else. Okay, maybe if you're a bit more social than me, sure, okay, like maybe there's, you actually have a social life and I don't. But yeah, that's something I was really pushing myself to do, was learning everything. I'm in Europe, it's got so much rewards if you look for it, that's what I wanted.
Okay, yeah. So you went from an analyst to a commentator, would you say? Like you were just on the desk analyzing and then you picked up more actual like casting gigs, probably coming in from the color perspective, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you ever consider going into to play-by-play? Have you looked at that as another place to branch into?
I do it a bit in CSGO because I find CSGO to be naturally easier to play-by-play. I think it's a much easier FPS to pick up. If you're familiar with other FPS games and you went and played CSGO, it would only take you a few games to work out the fundamentals of the game. I know it's more intricate than that when you get down to the nitty-gritty of things, but really on the base level, I think if you came in with even a foundational knowledge of FPS, you could understand CSGO. So for me, I don't mind play-by-play casting it, because it does tend to go in waves. And so if you can spot the waves in a round of CSGO, you know, generally the executioner, or there's a rush up banana, I mean, they're pushing B quite clearly. For me, that's very easy to play-by-play, whereas Siege is so much more difficult. There's like five waves around and you never know when it's going to hit. So you actually have to be a hybrid in Siege to begin with. Otherwise, the cracks will appear very quickly. So I'm glad I did some play-by-play in CSGO, because it led me into being a color caster for Siege a lot more appropriately. Otherwise, it would be clear that I struggled doing any hybrid play-by-play, because you're going to get caught in the action at any moment in Siege. And I think that's why being okay at play-by-play has done well for me. So yeah.
Siege is really an interesting esport. I've tried watching it a couple of times, some offline events, like where I was there anyways, as well as some online stuff. I was watching your broadcast just like an hour ago.
Oh no.
No, it was great. It is like an entirely different tempo, and that's what I'm learning the more that I actively watch other esports as opposed to just like passive listening. Very different tempo. Back up a little bit, and you said that brands, you know, having a brand for yourself, building a brand for yourself, actually caught some flack. What happened? Why did it happen?
I don't know what to really blame it on or give contrast to. Maybe because a lot of other coaches weren't doing it, but mind you, a lot of players and coaches and beyond weren't doing it. Really, it was only talent that were giving themselves huge brands beyond their work, and that for whatever reason was acceptable. But the moment that a player or a coach was focusing on their brand or their content outside of the game, then suddenly it was seen that they weren't putting enough work into their primary career. And I always thought to myself, but why? What do you expect me to coach 24/7, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? I'm like, that's how that works. Like, I'm there for the boys' scrims, I'm there for the reviews, I'm there for meetings, I'm there for all their official games, I'm there to meet with them individually to do mental coaching. I mean, if I have hours around all of my work, I do a map analysis of the opponents. I mean, my apologies if I'm efficient and that time left over. So for me, I think the flack came from people turning around and going, and I hate to put it this way, turn around and going, you're doing all this extra stuff that you technically shouldn't have time for because I don't know how to fit it into my schedule. And I sort of thought to myself, well, that's your bad, bro. Like, there were other coaches who criticized me for saying, I don't know how you have hours in the week. Okay, well then come watch me. Like, sorry, I'm doing my job. And I got criticized that whenever the team failed, it had to have somehow been as a result of me streaming the game on a weekend. You know what I mean? Just, it doesn't make sense.
That's very interesting. That's a phenomenon I haven't heard of before. I mean, I guess it kind of happened in StarCraft. We didn't really ever have coaches. It was a very loose term, coaches, in the non-Korean state of things back in 2010. But anyways, I mean, I do think there was that stigma, but then I would have thought that that was a very StarCraft thing, because StarCraft has always been like 1v1 hardcore. You got to have, you know, high expectations. They're very polite, very like, we kind of modeled the Korean culture in a way where it was like politeness and hard work and overworking, to be honest, and all that. So when we we heard that someone was trying to actively build a brand, or they weren't just playing 16 hours a day, I feel like there was maybe some flack there. But as I said, I would have figured that was a player thing, and I would have figured that was a StarCraft thing. So to hear it coming from coaches in Rainbow Six, that's I kind of get how that can happen. Of course, I don't agree with it, but I get how that can happen. But that is fascinating. That is. I mean, yeah, at a certain point, it's just them admitting that they don't, you know, they don't actually have like time constraints and the ability to organize.
They were called out on it a few times. And these were Twitter comments as well, to say like, I don't know how, if I don't have hours in the week, I don't know how you have hours in the week. I sort of thought to myself, like, I don't know how to argue this. What do you want me to do? Video my daily schedule to prove? Like, and I thought to myself, then I don't have to prove to you anything. And at the time, it was one of those things where I did feel I had to prove myself a lot compared to a lot of other support staff. And that was really brutal, but I mean, I put myself in the spotlight by wanting a brand as well. So I think that elevated the necessity for people to look at me and like sort of scrutinize what I do and how I do it, because I was being so outward with it. So I think it was a give and take as well.
I mean, having a public persona is going to get you more of that criticism. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And that's, I guess, something that coaches, like, that's one perk to being a coach, that usually you don't have to be out in the open, especially in esports, where we don't, like, you know, typically put the coaches on the interview desk after the game, you know, like a NBA or something. That's so interesting. And also just the idea, by the way, that like Rainbow Six has like all these dedicated coaches is also just kind of a foreign world for StarCraft right now, but it's pretty interesting. So are you still interested in coaching? Did you just entirely transition away from it?
I did end up getting a job in Italy. The timeline's a bit skew if, I guess, people who are listening to this go, wait, you were in Switzerland, then you're in Germany. And then I had a break a little bit where I was doing just content for a while. So I moved from Zurich to Berlin, Berlin to Hamburg. I was doing content in Hamburg, and then I got picked up by an organization in Milan who wanted their tier 3 team to be propelled into tier 2, and they want to win their nationals, which is a very prideful thing in Italy. To be the Italian victors is like every Italian organization, like, they want it. And so I didn't realize there was as much money in that tier as there sometimes can be in tier 1. I didn't realize there was that much backing, but Samsung was the full investors of this organization, so not a surprise they had the funds to sort of bring me in. So they got me in, got my own apartment. They had a full gaming house, which was a literal 2-minute walk from the apartment. I mean, it was awesome. I loved it. Then we spent a month and a half essentially doing everything we can to get my visa. And naturally, the Italian, you know, system was just like, esports, keyboard, we don't understand. I mean, you're a criminologist, not a... I'm like, oh. Oh, esports is a real thing. These kids are making money. I am literally their coach. So we tried the mental coaching route. We tried everything. We really honestly tried everything, to the point where I just said, look, let's cut ties here. We'll just void the contract. We'll agree to void if that's something that you're okay with. Luckily, I did, because I pretty much straight after I announced that, Ubisoft reaches out to me and goes, want to work the world championships? And I'm like, hell yeah, I want to work the world championships as an analyst. Get me in. I love that stuff. I'm ready to go. I'm already trained up. And so I get in on that. And that was when I also worked the Dubai World Championships for Girl Gamers for CSGO. So I literally had to fly from Australia to, because I had to move back to Australia from Italy because of the lack of visa. Flew to Montreal for the grand finals, worked that every day for like however many freaking days in a row, then flew straight to Dubai to work however many days of the CSGO grand finals, then all the way back to Australia, where a week later, my entire country locked down from COVID.
Mm. Good times, yeah.
200 IQ though, but but I will say that I'm so glad that I got those grand finals. I got I did end up working the grand finals. There you go. I got the world champs of the Six Invitational. And right before I walk onto the grand final analyst stage, I got pulled aside by one of the head EMEA people. They said, we are bolstering our talent team. We're actually segregating North America and EU. Who does what? Who lives where? We're going to do a LAN system for NA. And then for EU, we need to separate our talent. They all must be at a studio in Paris and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking to myself, where is this going? What is the point of this discussion? Right before I'm going to go on the desk for the grandfather, like, what do you want? And he goes, so we want to add you full time to our team in Paris. And I was like, you're telling me this right now before I go get on the grand final desk, my first ever world championship grand final analyst desk. You're telling me the most exciting news that is going to change my life right now. And ooh, I had to chill out walking up to the desk. I'm shaking. I'm trying to chill. I'm trying to work out what I'm going to say, you know, and analyze about the game. And my mind is just the whole time. So if I stuffed up that grand finals desk, ladies and gentlemen, blame Ubisoft. It was them telling me stuff before I should have known. I tell you that much.
You know, it's usually a negative thing, though, that throws people off. So at least there's that.
True.
It's an extremely positive thing. So. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. I do actually remember a lot of talk. I remember a lot of people on social media. I ended up watching quite a few Rainbow Six people that were all discussing like the benefits and downsides of this new system.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, and then it kind of just like, I think it like died off, of course, because COVID. So it kind of just like petered out, and then everyone was doing the online thing. And they're like, well, I guess this is what we're doing, you know, for an indefinite amount of time. So that really sucks, because it like Rainbow Six was just like, it really felt like it was exploding. Like it already felt like it was going to do really, really well back when I first heard of it. And then, you know, obviously a dedicated fan base, but then it just kept on exploding, getting bigger and bigger. And I mean, it's still, you know, doing fine, of course, but I just, it sucks not to have that like really structured tournament from a game that came from a little more of humble beginnings and actually just was so well loved that it continued to grow. And that's what I really liked about Rainbow Six, because, and this will always be the thing to like hold up and make fun of, Overwatch was this completely artificial, like, we're just going to go in completely and have an Overwatch League pre-planned, like, even as, like, they make this game, right? So they have, like, 2 years of, like, community content. They're like, just kidding, like, everyone, you know, Overwatch League's coming. And Rainbow Six just seemed like it was so much more of that, like, kind of, like, esports thing where it was, you know, well-loved by the developer and then well-loved by the community, and they just kept building. So I always thought that was like an awesome part of it. Not to knock on anyone who works in Overwatch, I just I wasn't a fan of their approach to it.
I mean, a lot of people have knocked Overwatch, so I think you'll be the 1 millionth in one person to do it, which is a bit of a shame. And I, not to doubt what Overwatch's vision was, but I think for Siege it just fell into a story that worked. Whereas Overwatch really tried to shove it down everyone's throats and said, this is the vision we want, you must take it, and otherwise it won't work. Whereas the people who were year one pro league for Siege, like that was the most scuffed thing I have ever seen. And Ubisoft was so not ready for this to pop off as a huge esport. They're like year one, they're like, oh, people really want to play this competitively. Oh, people are holding tournaments. Okay, a lot of this is on console. Let's do the console thing. And then like a year or two later, they're like, hang on, now we have to do the PC thing because other FPS games are doing the PC thing. So half of the console people had to move to PC, relearn mechanics, and then become pros on PC, and just to stay with their teams or organizations or wherever it was. So I tell you what, there is a story for Siege coming from humble beginnings of tripping and falling into being great. And I will say that COVID stalled quite a lot of the really explosive growth that was coming by partnering with FaceIt in the big regions and stuff like that. So I think people haven't really seen what we're made of just yet. Wait until the lands really hit and things will look really spicy.
Right, yeah. I mean, the grand finals, I did watch a bit of that. The one that, you know, before COVID hit was quite a spectacle. It was spectacular. I think like the finals were actually really good as well, if I recall correctly.
Oh, reverse sweep.
Yeah. Woo. So that's always, you know, that's always the one, the desire. But yeah, you guys have just been doing amazing. So it sounds like they're like, the fact that you have tier three stuff like in Italy is just that is a very, very healthy sign. I'm definitely very jelly. Not just heap praise on Rainbow Six. Back to commentating. So, sure. So you actually said that you just kind of reached out and pointed out that there is a lack of women in the industry, in the field for Rainbow Six at the very least. Let's be honest, it is pretty much the industry. And you said you got some flack from that, which I totally was expecting that. But I'm interested to know how actual conversation went, if you're willing to tell. Like, were they?
Yeah.
Did they receive that information okay? Or are they kind of like, well, you know, these white guys are definitely the best. So like, it's not our fault. Like, what was that conversation?
This is the most boring story you're going to get. Made the tweet, tagged them. They responded with like eye emojis or some simple crap like that. Next day I get an email, hey, want to come do the UK Spring Finals?
Wow.
I mean, honestly, it was just like ask and get. It was like a transactional thing with no feelings involved. They obviously had a meeting about it unbeknownst to me. And I definitely think that it's one of those things that they turned around and went, why not? She's a professional coach. She's been to the world championships as a coach. She was a player beforehand. What's the downside? Go figure. I mean, and I initially thought when I made the tweet, poking fun at the fact that they didn't have women and saying, get me in, people are like, what makes you think you're better? And I sort of thought to myself, hang on a second, my resume speaks for its fucking self. Excuse you, I'm a professional. I've been in the world chat. I've been a player. I have over 5,000 hours in this game played alone, not even competitively, just in ranked. I mean, I can tell you how to play this game with my eyes closed. So if you're asking about my resume, unlike the men, like who came in originally, Parker is a great example, Valley's another example, who had played 100 hours of this damn game, throw some respect on my name. I know what I'm talking about. And I'm very confident in it. Whereas if you ask me about Valorant, I would say, no, don't throw respect on my name. Let me earn that eventually, please, because I'm not there yet. So there's a difference where the confidence is applied in my line of work. Mm. That was such an insult to me because I was like, why should I have to list my resume? I know I'm good to go.
Yeah, I kind of remember a lot of the drama, I guess, if you wanna put it that
always
way.
Always drama.
Yeah, there's always drama. That is very true. But I kind of remember that. I kind of remember the I'm like, who's this like Jessica girl, and why does she like? Why mm-hmm. is her name Jessica? It's too many Jessicas in the world. But
too many.
And I didn't know what to expect because I wasn't really familiar with the scene. But did you let any of that criticism actually get to you? Did you use it as like a point of like, I'm gonna prove all those suckers wrong?
I think over my career a lot of the criticism has gotten to me. And it's not criticism from random people in chats and stuff like that. And people say, oh, because you pointed out, you must be butthurt. Well, no, I pointed out because I want a better culture for our scene and our community, one which I've loved and flourished in, you know, over the past however many years I've been in Siege, 5 years in total, I guess it's coming up. So I point that stuff out, things in Twitch chat, things in comments and stuff like that, because I want to embarrass people. I love using, you know, shame to be able to point out to people that you shouldn't say these things. We're going to call you out. You're going to look dumb. When it came to professional, I wouldn't even call it criticism. I wouldn't even go as nice to say as that. It's just people pointing fingers from other professional areas of our game or other games or whatever it might be, wherever in the esports industry it is. Then I had to take a step back and say to myself, well, actually, yeah, a lot of this does get to me because when I was a criminologist, I was the youngest in the law faculty. I was so worried that being so young, so inexperienced, I would be talked down to. I would be mansplained things because there's not a lot of women in the law faculty. So you have to really stand strong and be confident. I tell you what, not a single person, people 40 years my senior plus are sitting there asking my criminological advice on one of their additions to their exam. I've never been treated with so much respect as I was when I was in the university. Then I go from the university into esports, and it is the polar opposite. The spectrum could not be wider. The divide was as big as a valley. And I don't think I could come to terms with how different the respect level was in being non-endemic career-wise, and then coming in and trying to be endemic to Siege, or rather to talent and coaching and so on and so forth, and realizing that people don't care if you've got a stacked resume. Some don't care because you're a woman. Some don't care because they just want to be better than you and it's a dog-eat-dog world. I mean, I've never felt like I'm watching my back more than I have when I've been in esports in any position.
I was on a cast with a podcast, there was episode of this one with Gillyweed. I think the way that we put it was that it's a marathon that you never finish and you just keep looking back. Yeah, there's no like end point of like, oh, I made it. So
thank you guys. Ooh, I've never thought of it like that. Wow, that's a great analogy. It's also a sad analogy, but it's a great analogy.
Right, yeah, it makes it sound like it's you know, nothing but exhausting and also potentially backstabby. If they're behind you, they're gonna backstab
yes.
you. So it, you know, it can definitely be construed as just like, well, that's a bad sign. But it, I, for what we were talking about, I was kind of more so on the point of like, it's exhausting being like out in the public image as a content creator in general. It feels like you're constantly reinventing yourself and always trying to determine like what the audience wants and then trying to figure out what the audience wants, which means you got to get down into the muck occasionally and read all the dumb comments.
Yep.
And it's just, it is really difficult, especially, yeah, you know, for women. I don't usually try to like make it a point to talk about that issue on this podcast because sometimes it's really overdone. But this is also one of the times where it's like woman to woman and also like a decent amount of time to talk about it instead of just like, give me one sentence to describe the whole problem. So, yeah, I think one of the big things for me And I don't know if you had similar things too, but there's also this kind of weird thing that happens with, like, there's also like types of women that are acceptable in the esports. Like,
oh yeah.
And I'm going to sell my story, but like I came in very like low-key community, like really built myself up over years. And then I was like very much like a part of the scene. You know, I had the people in chat mm-hmm. being like, nah, she's cool, she's great, which has been the case for me in like sports as well. Like, I joined a rugby team and some jackass would join and be like, oh, a woman, and then the guys would defend me, and that's great. But I was also not very feminine, you know. I was definitely a tomboy growing up and didn't really care about my looks and all that good stuff, right? And I think a lot of guys actually were like, great, not a Twitch thought or whatever they call them, I don't remember, but
yes,
they were like, yes, we approve, you got the stamp of approval. And then mm-hmm. you know, you get to a certain point and it kind of feels like it actually turns around, where suddenly it's like, you're not feminine enough, you're not like doing the thing that a woman mm-hmm. usually does, which is, because there's also women who look fucking amazing and glamorous and just like, oh my goodness, amazing. And then of course for them, some people like them because they're like, oh, they're really nice, they're really bringing a, you know, encouraging atmosphere, positive atmosphere. But of course the downside is that they get the, you're just being pretty, you know,
you're a thought. I hate it.
There seems to be like two types again, like of women, and then like they're acceptable to a certain range of people, to a certain range.
You're never gonna get right in the middle. I do try and get right in the middle, and I will say it's only been in the past year I've really been able to hit it on the head as to how I think that fits with the archetype I deep down want to be, because I was so sick of just being what everyone else wanted me to be. Like you said, you know, growing up as a tomboy, I mean, geez, I played state football. I was bashing up against women twice as wide, twice as tall as me. I don't know how many concussions I walked off on the field with, multiple months. I mean, I've been roughing it out. Even now, like, I ride a motorbike to and from the office. I love snowboarding. I love, you know, surfing. I'm really hardcore tomboy, like as hardcore as you can be. And it's only been in the past year and a half, 2 years, that I started realizing, because it's not a choice, let's be honest. You have to realize at some point when you're in talent work that when you're on camera, there is so much pressure on you as a woman to outstage everyone else on the desk, especially if they're men. You have to be that feature piece. You have to look perfect. Your hair has to be perfect. Your shirt has to be ironed to a T. If you're not wearing a shirt, okay, your bra strap can't be showing. What about this? What about how we're using the glasses? How's your hair flowing? How do the eyelashes look? I mean, it's a constant thing. And if you work in events, the makeup artists spend quadruple the amount of time on you they do on the men. That's always going to happen. Mm-hmm. So I realized really quickly, and it was probably after SI 2020, that like I was not going to keep hacking it as like the cool chick with the cap and the jerseys. That wasn't going to hack it anymore, and I had to flip the feminine switch pretty quickly. And I'm okay with that, because what's the word when you like dressing both ways? I should know this. Androgynous.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, androgynous.
I'm rather androgynous with the way I dress, so I don't really care. And my partner loves me, you know, no matter what I dress. So I was comfortable, and I am comfortable. You can see the eyelashes. I kind of like them. But, you know, I love my tattoos just the same. And my hair, that's a never-changing thing. That's just one of the things I love. Just straighten my hair nice. But, yeah. It's a pressure and you cannot escape it. I don't care what esport you're from. If you say that you've escaped it, you've got to be the mastermind of the game. You've got to be like Valkyrie, 100 Thieves, co-owner level of respect to just have that kind of free reign over how you look or whatever. It's just, I don't want to be mean, but there have been some very untidy men on broadcast that I thought to myself, if I went on a broadcast the way you are presenting yourself on the broadcast, in your t-shirt, in your bomber jacket, with your hair barely brushed and your eyebrows pointing the wrong way, I'd be copping it in the Reddit comments right now. So that's my statement to men of the talent world out there. Put in some effort as well, please.
You know, it's actually something that, you know, as opposed to like, I don't want to, you know, be attacking anyone, and we're not, but it's like, I don't want to come off as being saying like, you got to do something if I'm that really, but I just usually do it all inclusive. I'm just like, honestly, guys, like the StarCraft 2 talent could be a lot snazzier. Like, I watch like some of the CSGO broadcasts, and they like sometimes like dressed to the nines, like super clean, super cut, and I'm just like, wow. Yeah, like they look really good.
They must be sponsored. They must be sponsored. Like because they're honestly, there's no way they're buying all of those tailored stuff. Right. I refuse to believe. I refuse to believe.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, we could certainly all of it. And being that person on camera is always going to have that expectation. But you're right, men have that lower bar for sure. They have to hit like a really low bar before they start getting comments about their looks. But you know, this like I was like really smiling during this because I actually was thinking of, you ever seen the movie Gone Girl?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously the movie is like the woman's like basically the evil person. I mean, she's got some reasons for what she did, but like she's not a great person. But one of those things that like, you know, like a lot of women actually like, oh yeah, is when she describes being the cool chick who's also the beautiful chick, right?
Yeah.
Like she was like, you got to be like great in bed and look fantastic all the time, but you also got to be willing to like eat a steak, you know, instead of a salad at a dinner because you gotta be cool too. And that seems to be like the kind of balance that you want to be.
What a good reference. You are full of references and analogies that I can only dream of one day being able to whip out, because geez, that's so good. That's literally what I think sometimes. Like if you read me on Twitter, which is why I have a secondary Twitter account, I let loose. I am badass Jess to a T. You will find me ripping words. I won't hold anything back. And then on my main, I'm like, hello, everyone. My name is Jessica. Welcome to my Twitter. And it's just like sometimes I let loose in my main because impression's pretty easy. But yeah, I do feel that way. I'm like, I got to be cool Jess, but then I'm going to be serious Jess, but then I'm going to be professional Jess. Mm-hmm. And then when I go to an event, I have to go from the desk of being hyper-professional, and then 2 seconds later, when one of the buddy old pals across from me and the camera is like, high five, boom, I got to be like, yeah, what's up, you know, like, I'm exhausted. I'm getting whiplash from all these identities I'm having to hold on.
Yeah, it's funny. Do you think that it's also, like, the way that Siege is presenting itself as an esport? Do you think that impacts it as well? Like, how suit and tie are you guys compared to, I guess, from a scale of, like, Overwatch when it first was released to a fighting game, I think has been my spectrum so far.
I would say we are slowly moving up the spectrum towards an Overwatch-esque vibe. Purely because now that we have a bigger talent pool, there's been a need to fight for survival. There were casters that didn't have to fight for survival before because they were the only ones that had a monopoly. Now that that monopoly is absolutely shredded, now everyone's going, well, how can I look better? How can I sound better? Who can I duo with to just naturally be better? Which region can I be in to solidify my spot, you know, for as long as possible? And that comes into it. Looking good has absolutely been a part of it. And I made a big point at Six Invitational of wearing gold shirts to represent, you know, winning gold and being a winner and so on and so forth. And I was always making a very heavy emphasis on that because it was also a bit representative for me, symbolic. And so I noticed that the other members of my desk, you know, Alex Zeronic, a good friend of mine, he would wear a gold, glittered, full, fitted,
<You've seen it.
laughs> you know, yeah. And then, okay, well, then Milos was like, all right, let me ask the makeup artist to get gold glitter for my beard. So he has it. And we're starting to team up and we're starting to think, how can we outdo the other desks? And yes, I wouldn't say it comes off naturally just being competitive, but I have noticed that if I watch myself back, which I hate doing and most talent do, but if I watch myself back, is the person I'm seeing on the screen someone that psychologically, because you can't get around it, people are going to have a first impression basis? Am I someone that leaves a good first impression? And what they see, if you're muted on the screen, will make you them unmute sometimes. And I've come to that, you know, a realization over time that, yeah, just have certain button-ups, certain color schemes, you know, matching when I do APAC, I'll wear maroon because that's the orangey maroon vibe. When I'm on EUL, I wear brighter colors. So I'm always thinking about the psychology of things.
Dang, that's a lot more than I was expecting. But maybe that's your background coming in, right? It's criminologist.
I'm probably a little bit more analytical, especially when it comes to psychosocial or psychological stuff. I'm always thinking of it.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's still pretty cool. And I think I agree, like, overall with the whole sentiment that, like, sometimes what's happening on the screen can make a person just be like, oh, mute, desk, analyst, you know, nope.
Yep.
Versus actually being like, okay, what's happening? For me, I would say that like a lot more times, if they're having fun, if they're being a little more casual, I've always been more inclined to unmute, you know, like that it's not just people with like the stance, you know, the stance that analyst desk always have. And then, you know, they're like a certain space away and they're doing like everything just like, you know, super professional and it looks nice. Yeah. That's true. But I don't know, you know, unless I'm really into the game, because that's also another thing, right, is appealing to the casuals versus the people who want the analysis. Like, which one are you trying to go for? And unless I'm really into the game, I'm going to want more of the bands, more of the fun times, right? Where do you think Siege is right now, or where do you think you are right now as a commentator and analyst in trying to hit the casual versus super dedicated audience?
I would say if we went back and we compared how I performed and the kind of rigidness I had at SI 2020 on the analyst desk, I was nothing but straight cut. I was robotic Jess to a T, hitting every single piece of strat analysis like a robot reading it out on Google Translate. Sorry to the audience for that. It was kind of the lecturer inside of me coming out and just going, fact, breakdown, analysis, fact, goodbye, thank you for being here. You know, like, that's not fun. I'm an entertainer at the end of the day. And since me being implemented as a full-time talent, I was told with like 2 or 3 months to spare, which is not a long time, that I would be not just an analyst, but I would also be a caster. And that struck fear deep into me that I would be going into T1 as a caster when realistically I hadn't done a lot of consecutive casts at even a semi-professional level to warrant me being a caster in T1. I'm one of those people that even though people have done it in Siege, Parker, Valley, many others who've come in and they've not had almost any background in Siege and they just pick it up, I don't agree with that. I think there is a leveling system you need to go through, especially in a very, very tough game like Siege, especially if you want to be a color caster, especially maybe a play-by-play, you can get away with it. So I definitely think I was rigid, like no tomorrow, you couldn't, I was like an ice pick. And I eventually learned as the feedback started to roll in that I'm an entertainer and what I do on Twitch is entertaining. And people would point out the stark comparison between Twitch Jess and then work Jess. And I was like, why do I have these two different people that I'm constantly showing everyone? You know what I mean? I'd go from a broadcast and then straight after I'd stream and people are like, whoa, you're the same person? Well, yeah, maybe I'm just thinking too much about the professionalism. And I've slowly started to break that down as I've developed duos with the different talents, so on and so forth. I'm lucky to say that I have finally worked out you can have a laugh, you can poke fun at your co-casters, you can, you know, have those little bits of banter. But unfortunately for Siege, the moment you try and stray away, if you're not on the desk, if you're in the cast, and even if you just try and stray away from the topic, even just for 10 seconds, you just want 10 seconds, have a laugh at your co-caster about something, the chat will fill with cringe. It won't matter if it's legitimately funny. It won't matter if it's it's anything, right? Cringe will come no matter what. So I don't know. I think we're still working out what the fine middle line of that all is.
I think it goes back to balance. Like, you kind of have to be two different people again, and you kind of have to be two different people at different times of your career, which, you know, you want to prove that you know your stuff. So that has to be kind of be part of like what happens. And then you kind of eventually have to prove you're also like you're entertaining. So I would say a lot of the times it does, like, from, well, my perspective might be skewed the more I'm doing this podcast, but that it does usually come from like, I know the game, I have to prove myself that I belong in this game.
Maybe, and that's then, what it was.
I think there are a few people who can just be purely entertaining, like Uber is, I think, one of them. Like, he seems to be able to transplant anywhere and people are just like, that was great, that was fun. So love to have his skill, but for a lot of other talent, it's definitely more like, I gotta prove myself and then I'm gonna relax. I was even like told, actually, the first, so I'd been casting like online like so long before I got my first like big official offline gig, and I had a co-caster tell me like, look, like just hang out with the crew and be, you know, be cool with everyone, And that's going to go a much longer way than you trying to like spew facts everywhere. And I did believe him. He was not wrong. I 100% mm-hmm. believed him. That was exactly what I was focusing on because I wasn't part of the main crew. And especially mm-hmm. for StarCraft, that R is a game where you could absolutely spend a good 5 minutes, if not longer, talking about whatever the hell you want.
Shit.
Absolutely. That's what Tastosis is mostly known for, is that they can mm-hmm. fill the dead air. Yeah, that was incredible advice. It was still so difficult for me to actually do it. Even after being in StarCraft as like a pretty solid community member for like 4 years before this, mm-hmm. I still, you know, absolutely needed to prove myself that I could bring the stats and the analytical mind along with entertaining. But it's so difficult to get that balance right from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And that's usually why you have more of a build-up. Then what right. it sounds like you kind of had just like get on the analyst desk for the biggest thing in the world, be perfect.
Right. I mean, I say that, and I had experience. Like, I couldn't turn around and, you know, say to Ubisoft, "Oh, I'm so sorry if I stuffed something up. I'm brand new here." Well, technically, I'm not really brand new because I did the UK stuff, and then I did the Benelux stuff in the Netherlands, and then I did other stuff. And really, technically, I should have come in going, "Hey, I'm totally ready to go." As an entertainer, I absolutely was not. Mm. And I am probably even just sitting here listening to you explain it and put in such simple terminology. I suppose the minutiae of it is that I did cop a lot of flack for who is she, what does she know, and therefore having to overcompensate for that in the way that I presented myself as an analyst and as a color commentator. And I still thoroughly believe there needs to be people like me on the desk, but that they need to be balanced out by the other people on the desk. I don't think, especially in Siege, that it is appropriate in any way, shape, or form to have a banter crew. They try that, and it is god-awful. It's like it's like me watching some kind of weird Twitch stream where three Twitch like Siege dudes joke around whilst playing ranked. Like, if I wanted that, I'd go watch a YouTube video, you know what I mean? It didn't give any depth to the game, of which the game had so much depth to begin with. So instead, I started to think about how can you make learning fun? How can I start taking the stuff that's on your screen, giving you replays, and having a laugh? Can I use analogies? Can I tease a player inside the lobby and say, absolute rookie move, moving that ADS from A to B or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, you know, people can learn the game that way. And that's when I've best gotten the best feedback from community and bosses and TOs as a whole, was when I could find that balance between, we still need to be analytical, we pay you for your brains, because let's be honest, I truly do think that's where most of my income does come from. It's my experience and my brains, not necessarily my entertainment factor. And I need to be able to mix in a nice little bit of garnish of entertainment on top of that.
A little parsley on top, yeah.
Yeah, just...
The more that I think critically about commentating, the more that I've actually boiled a lot of it down to having a wide vocabulary, but not just like being able to have synonyms in your brain for individual words, but phrases, like ways to describe things that are out of just the normal way you do it. I think that's what makes Uber a really fantastic caster all around. He has like 1,000 ways to explain the same thing, and he has all these like, they're not just like 1,000 ways to explain the same thing, they're also kind of funny sometimes, especially if they're like Australian slang, you know, and you're just like, ah, silly Australians. Which happens with our Australian StarCraft as well. But that's really what people like that's what they just kind of, they're not necessarily tuned in 100%. That's not the analysis. They're like, oh, what was that? Oh, that was super detailed. But they're just like listening, and they're like, that was fun, that was enjoyable. I, you know, there's a little bit of humor, and there is, you know, a little bit of, you know, it was kind of like a rise and a fall there because it was so different at every moment. And I actually think you guys are doing that fantastic in the last 30 minutes of the show I just watched before you got here. So I was like, damn, they have a lot of different ways. They're trying to really put in a lot of different ways to say something in very short amount of time. Very short.
That is the biggest thing to learn as a talent. And this is just like anyone who watches this that isn't already a talent or is in a game where you get a lot of freedom, let this be a warning to you. There is so much time spent in one match on Siege that when I get onto the analyst desk, I'm given 3 minutes, 25 seconds to explain an entire game that may have gone to OT. Now, if I am doing my best to get out, like I'm talking hundreds of notes into mere sentences, then I promise you that if you were in my position, you would struggle. I have never had to be as concise as this, not even as a lecturer, where you're like got the hour, an hour and a half, 2 hours, depending how long your lecture is or your tutorial that you're running. I thought I had to be concise then. I've never had to be so on point with my words, and every word and every phrase and every sentence had to be impactful. And if you took the funny route, you missed out on the analytical route, and you're hoping that your duo picks up on that. Otherwise, it just seems like you're both having a laugh on the desk, right? Sometimes that works, other times not so much, especially in Siege. So for me, that's a huge warning to people, is that they don't realize is that you don't get to speak about everything you're ready to go with. And sometimes you have to nitpick.
Mm-hmm. And then on, as well with that, like you bring up a co-caster, it's also like you don't get to say everything that you wanted to say sometimes, mm-hmm. right? Like if they brought up a point and you wanted to extrapolate on it, sometimes it's not good to do that. Sometimes you just got to mm-hmm. be like, yep, that was a good point. That summed it up well enough. Let's move on. Let's do the joke. Let's be the play-by-play. Which, as you were saying, Siege is a bit of a mix of both. Like, you're going to be at both at the same time. It also requires a lot of trust in your co-commentator. And as I feel like I've not seen a whole lot of pairs in Rainbow Six, but please educate me. Do you guys pair up usually, or is it more of a mix and match?
We do these days, especially. I mean, the whole duo vibe kicked off with Kix and Intero, Parker and Michael, who and Michael recently just won Colorcaster of the Year. So I feel pretty safe in being able to use him as a grand example of being one of the best colorcasters, not only in all of esports, but most definitely as an idol in Siege as to how a good colorcaster should be. But I do think that there's differing opinions in management as to how duos should or should not be, or should or should not exist. Mm. And I am strongly for them, because I will give you the best example. Ace just recently joined our team from the Latin American scene. He had to move over to our team, and now we've got five. That's an odd number. That's a horrific number to work with in a talent team. Six if you include our host, but of course, Miloshi only hosts, so he's not going to cast. And so you think about Ace being added, my normal duo being Desertu, we have worked for however many months straight during lockdown online in horrific hours for me, working on segmentation, on what the timer should look like at certain throws and catches, how that will sound in the duction of our voice and the intonation, how the flow will go, the tone I'm going to use when he needs to be prepared to pick up, the delay of my voice going all the way from Australia to the UK and him having to be prepared to pick that up even with the delay. I mean, there's so much we've practiced and we are nowhere near perfect. Absolutely not. And so I get Ace and they go, well, Jess, Ace can play by play and you can color cast. So how about you do 50-50 Des, 50-50 Ace? And I'm like, that's very nice that you believe in my abilities as someone who's been casting professionally for a mere year. But let me tell you this. Putting you in a brand new duo is a nightmare. It is an incredible nightmare in this game where there is so much strategy. It's like a MOBA FPS, right? That is what Siege is. And if you take away the structure in a round, you will do what, and I hate to throw them under the bus this way. I love Des and Ace dearly. Sometimes Des and Ace will pair, and sometimes Ace and I will pair. Sometimes Ace and Fluke will pair. It's a nightmare. This five thing is a nightmare. Anyway, it'll change soon, I'm told, you know, post-COVID stuff. But the worst cast I listen to as someone who enjoys the game from an analytical / semi-entertainment perspective was when Ace and Des duo together, who are both play-by-plays, I feel, and they were together. And I reckon maybe after the entire match, I heard three mentions of the strategy, maximum. And I went to myself, I'm not here to have a laugh. It's okay to like enjoy the game, but you could have intertwined the strategy into a bit of laugh about how he died to a frost mat or how that shield didn't block him. What an idiot. Why didn't you stay behind the shield? I mean, I hated listening to it. And I told them both this. I said, I did not enjoy you two casting together because you both are hybriding with each other to the point where you don't have any strict segmentation. Mm. No one's analyzing ever. And so maybe I'm just so one way inclined. Maybe I'm so logically sided that I can't seem to understand that maybe to the average viewer, that's okay. But that's not where Siege is at the moment, unfortunately. And I don't think Siege is growing into a more casual player base by any means, by any means, it is going much in the opposite direction. And casters who start to understand that duos and segmentation is the future, being adaptable is fine. Be adaptable in your role. Stop pretending you do every role like a professional. You'd sink in another game. You would. I would sink as a play-by-play in another game. Mm. Can't pretend I can do that. I'm not a professional at everything. So other casters who pretend they are, give me the heebie-jeebies, because if this game died tomorrow, there'd be no other game that would take them. No one wants a hybrid who does semi-mediocre at both roles.
Right. Mediocre at both roles, right. Yeah, it's. I think the trend is more so going to pairs, and I think that's also to do with the trend of what esports are popular. You know, you're talking a lot about why Siege in particular feels like it's so needed for this, and then Overwatch has done the same thing, and I'm like, oh, I totally get that. I'm amazed by the commentators who cast Overwatch, because I think that game is so difficult. But the but in general, like, it seems to be trending in that direction. And it's also just, like, it's very good for branding is one of the big things. If you're not thinking about, like, the very technical stuff, it's very good for branding. We have Tastosis, who are now doing Valorant a bit as well. But, you know, there's a reason they have an Archon name, because they've been doing it forever, Tasteless and Artosis. So, and their branding and other circumstances have made them, like, the kings, like, the top, like, kind of untouchables in some way.
Have that in Siege, yes.
Well, that's what I was getting to, because I kind of know that. So you brought it up a couple of times, but then there is that whole idea of, like, there are sometimes pairs that are seen as so much better. So when you try to banter for 30 seconds or less and chat goes cringe, if they do it, that might not happen.
It's totally okay. Yeah. I'm so glad you brought this up, because I spoke to Des the other month. Might have even been longer ago. Time is flying and going slow all at once. It's a weird paradox. But I pulled up a clip where Intero had spent, and I love Intero dearly, Intero had spent 45 seconds straight talking about something about one of the operators and why it should be something, something, right? Irrelevant to the round, irrelevant to the teams, irrelevant to the matchup as a whole. Just went on this rant, right? And everyone chats like, I agree, blah, blah, blah. And I clipped that. I linked that to Des, my duo, and I said, if I had pulled this same stunt on stream, I'd be getting shredded on Reddit. I'd be getting shredded on Twitter. I'd be having the comments going, speak about the game casters. Who's the casters? Stupid casters. Like, I'm telling you, there is this echelon of unreachableness that Kicks and Parker get as a result of being, of having the monopoly of being the first casters to get people's respect. And as a result, it's almost like a lot of viewers' respect only goes to them. Mm-hmm. And it's like they can't diversify that at all. And that's where you, it's an unwinnable battle. That's something I've come to learn really recently, is if people are going, oh, where's Kicks and Intero? They're so much better, blah, blah, blah. Let them die on that hill, because all of the new players that we're bringing in by being less gatekeepy and in opening up our community and our game is growing exponentially, then those new viewers will come in. I bring in viewers from my own brand and stream who are very active in chat, and I love them dearly for it. I don't have to be worried about the fanboys, because the OGs are dying out at a faster, much more rapid pace than the people who are coming in as new viewers to our game. So they will overwhelm the OGs more often than not. So I always have to think about that, even though it does seem oppressive sometimes that Kicks and Parker are just unbeatable. If they don't cast a final, that's unthinkable, you know? Like,
I know exactly. This is exactly the same circumstance that existed, like, past tense for so long. It kind of changed with COVID and then being in Korea. And then also before that, they had missed out on a couple of the global championships, or not globals, but the really big events. So it was kind of started to change just from, like, outside circumstances, but definitely not because the people stopped liking them. Like, it still got the comments of, like, we still do every day. Like, where's Tastosis? Why aren't they casting the finals? And it feels like there's so many things that are attributing to that. Like, brand is certainly one of them. Pairing, I think, is another one. We don't really get to pair in StarCraft, which I'm 50-50 on, like, whether I would like to, actually. I'm actually leaning more towards what we are right now, which is not pairing, but that's an aside. But then there's also just, like, yeah, they've just been there for so long, and they have so many people that like them, and it's such an old esport as well that has it's, like, hardcore fan base. We've had, you know, definitely more people coming in with free-to-play, but It's definitely different from Rainbow Six, which is a bit newer, even though it did start a while ago. And I actually remember Livin' Pink, a StarCraft player, being on the team that was developing Rainbow Six Siege. They started a while ago, but it's, you know, it's really exploded only recently. I think you're absolutely right. Like, eventually it's going to kind of turn over, but it feels impossible. It feels like, you know, even the new people, when they're like, who do I listen to? The first thing they get told is listen to those guys, right? And that kind of just like gives them like a baseline expectation or just like understanding where like, well, if everyone said they're okay, if I say they're okay, then I'm in and smart and like I'm with the crowd. And if I try to like dissent and be like, no, I think this person's better, then maybe I don't know what I'm talking about or whatever.
I think considering the regions have been divided, this has given us freedom to breathe. If Kicks and Intero were in the European and APAC North talent team, we'd be suffocated. Without a doubt, we'd be suffocated. I got told in a meeting at the end of last year, which was one of, I cried after, and then I went out for breakfast to celebrate, but I got told in a meeting that Des and I were the face of Europe. Oh. And when you get told something like that, and then I won an award from the Gamers Award, and then it just all exploded in my brain to going, I did a thing really quickly I didn't think I'd do. I thought it would take me about 2 to 3 years before I would really make a dent as a talent. And I'm telling you now, I cried like a little girl, you know, get the little stereotypes in, cried like a little girl and let it all out. And I went, sheesh, I really did a thing, but I worked so incredibly hard and I was very open to criticism to the point where I told people, I want you, like, excuse my French, tell me I'm fucking shit and then like rip me apart. Go to town with my work and pull it apart like you've never pulled something apart. You will not hurt me. In fact, you are helping me. And the people who did that made me the caster I am today. And no matter how brutal they were, I won't thank anyone more than that kind of brutality. I needed it. That's it. I had breathing room because fortunately for them, because they probably make more money in North America, let's be honest, the bubble over there is unbelievable. But they moved to NA, they're doing NA. We got breathing room in EU. As a result, we look a lot more amateur rookie because we are bringing up rookie casters into the tier one, myself included. I mean, I suppose I worked SI, so I wasn't really, but it doesn't really matter. And I got to build my own foundation away from the expectations a little bit. You know, you weren't, you know, changing games where the big boys were on and then you were on and it was just a stark contrast. No, I think that was the best thing that could have ever have happened to me. So, yeah.
That's a very good point. I feel like I've considered it before, but because StarCraft, we not only mix and match our commentators, like every day is a new surprise, we also don't break up our regions, really. So North America and Europe are the same commentators. Sometimes you do like 8-hour days and it kind of sucks, but that's what we've been doing. So yeah, we don't get the opportunity to build that brand, but if you do, if you kind of get segmented, which a lot of other esports are doing, absolutely. Most other esports are doing what Rainbow's doing. Then that makes a lot of sense that you could kind of build that and brand there. And then of course it helps if your region's actually doing particularly well. Like if you're only representing, you know, like Hong Kong, Japan, Taipei or something like that. Maybe if you're a great commentator, like you're not really gonna get the recognition, but seems like, you know, a lot of right place, right time. And then for you, it's especially like putting in the effort and like making the most out of the opportunities. So you were literally in Europe at one point, you did everything you could, you're representing Europe as a commentator while you live in Australia, right? So still kind of the same deal. And what most do you attribute to your rapid success now that you can kind of look back on and be like, I did that thing? Was it, I mean, what specifically, if you're going to say hard work, what specifically about the hard work do you think contributed the most?
I would say for me, the phrase practice makes perfect is something that I apply to everything, like everything in my life, riding my motorbike, brushing my teeth. I Google how to do that better. I know it sounds so ridiculous, but if there was a way to do something better, I Google it. I took dance lessons. I learned how to salsa. I mean, I took singing lessons. I hate singing and I only sing in the shower and I will never sing for anyone, but I took singing lessons. I do everything I can if I feel I can't do something at all or I can't do something well. And I guess it's some kind of complex in my brain that goes, you want to be the master of everything. So if you're going to be the master, you got to practice it all the time and yada yada. And I was like, okay, if that's practice makes perfect, then here's what I'm going to do. I still do it to this day with commentating. I ride my motorbike to and from the office. I am whispering through my helmet, casting. I'm envisioning around in my mind, I'm casting. I go to bed, I mute one of the games for NAL because it starts when I go to bed usually, and I'll cast over the top of it and I'll go to sleep that way. I'm living and breathing however I can. When I'm thinking about my Twitch streams on the weekend, I'm thinking, which sponsors can I reach out to? Which sponsor managers can I get to network on Twitter? I have three of them. Got partnered with Stream Elements recently as well on their dream team. I mean, I'm making moves however I can make moves. I know it sounds exhausting, but when you have a passion to be the best at everything, if you don't put steps in place to really try and be the best, then you won't make it. And I think that's my biggest fear, is that one day I get bored of being better. And the day I get bored of being better will be the day that I truly have stopped living. So I'm terrified of that. And I never want to be that way.
It was very inspirational, and then it got kind of terrifying.
in a mental way, not quite a physical way, obviously. I've still got many years to go. Many, I hope. I'm still young.
But that is really inspiring. I feel like a lot of the, like, so I interviewed Sideshow, Overwatch guy, right? And I feel like you and him have kind of like a similar nature. I'll put it that way, like a similar nature where there's always like, and you could definitely speak more to this than I could, but like the, like kind of the intrinsic desires that we have, and whether we're influenced by outside things or internal things, and just having that, like that drive to like be mm-hmm. best at something, that's almost overpowering. I mean, it's almost like an alien like world to someone like me, who, you know, I'm really struggling with that desire and, you know, actually achieving self-actualization and all that stuff, mm-hmm. right? So when I listen to this, I'm just like, that sounds amazing. I'm going to do that. And then I know, like, after this, I'm going to be like, but Subnautica is really
it's
fun
exhausting.
Right now.
It is honestly mentally taxing to the point where I don't... how do I explain it? I think the best way to explain it is that it was kind of forced upon me. I spent most of my childhood and teenage years teaching myself things. My parents were both workers, not really there a lot of the time. Love them dearly, but, you know, smart workers. And as a result, you learn that you have to teach yourself things. And then I skipped a year of school, and I was always the youngest in the year. And so, okay, now you're the odd one out. So I read books a lot to compensate for that. I went to university at 17. Okay, couldn't go out drinking with my buddies, could I? So, you know, it just compacted constantly. I couldn't be on the in because of mostly age, but I was just constantly felt like it was always just me versus the world. You know, it's such a teenage thing to say, but I definitely felt that within me. And I was like, if I don't do the thing, I don't pay my rent, I don't finish my degree, I don't do A, B, C, D, E, F, G. No one is there to save me. And a lot of people might have a safety net or two. And I always felt, and I don't know if this is true or not, I don't know, maybe if I could have ever gone to my parents to provide some kind of life assistance, whether it be, you know, emotionally, mentally, financially, whatever. But I always consider myself to be like, it is me versus the world. There's no one else that's going to save me. Mm-hmm. So I think that might have carried into adulthood, which might not be, of course it's not a healthy thing to always be like overpowered by the need to be the best at everything. Mm-hmm. And that's probably why I don't have a lot of friends. I work 7 days a week. You know, shout out to my partner. She I don't know how she deals with me working as much as I do, probably because she's an aerospace engineer and she works just as much. So I guess I'm lucky that we're both busy in our own right. And she's insanely emotional, intelligent. So, I mean, I was lucky on that one. But, yeah, I think at one point I'm just going to get so exhausted of wanting to be the best. And what I want to do as I'm going into the future is just be okay with whatever results come of me doing my best. If me riding to and from the work and speaking out loud to myself under my motorbike helmet, or, you know, watching the muted Vaughn in bed, and I say some funny lines over it to see whether or not I find it hilarious or if it sounds good or not, or I'm watching other casters, or I get other people to pick on me and my casting, which I really enjoy. If that leads to me becoming a mainstay but never the top, have to be okay with that. I have to be okay with just being okay. And that's hard. I think that's hard for me to come to terms with. So, yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, there's positive negatives being the, you know, the stereotypical type A versus type B thing, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's actually really big, especially we're in an industry that both feels like there are caps and there aren't caps, if you know what I mean. Like,
right.
It feels like we can do everything because we have this like market space. You could say we did content creation. Mm. Technically, that's a big thing. We did commentary. Mm. Technically, that's a big thing. But then you think about what you're doing specifically. I'm a color commentator for Rainbow Six.
Yes.
What is the cap there? And that can be difficult to answer. And that could be difficult to think that you can get there and then accept if you don't get there. So for you, did you find like a good progression system was set up in Rainbow Six, and have you felt like you're reaching that cap? And is that one of the reasons that you're experimenting with other games?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that end point there. Is that for me, my ride in esports has been a million miles per hour. I have never once been able to stop and go, wow, look at all the things I did. Because I started off a player, and then I was an analyst, then I was a coach, and then I do desk analyst whilst I'm coaching, and then I'm moving to three different countries, and then I'm doing this, and now I'm working the grand finals, and oh my God, now I'm full time, and now I have to learn casting. And when did I take a breath? I don't think there was a time where I wasn't go, 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 go. Content creation as well, those months in Hamburg when I lived there, it was consistent all the way. I was just going 100 miles per hour. And I think all that time I was gaining success. You know, the upward trend of me gaining success was so sharp that I'm at a point now where I hope I hit a plateau, because I want myself to come to terms with the fact that it's not always up. Mm. And if you want it to continue to go up, it doesn't just come at 100 miles per hour. Some people work on this for years and years and years. Some people work on this for decades. It doesn't just get handed to you on a silver platter. I do think I've worked hard. But I never want that expectation of me working hard to then always in turn give me something in return. So I'm learning that now. I would be happy being recontracted as not necessarily the face of EU or not necessarily ever getting to cast grand finals of the World Championships. But the reason I'm trying other games now is I am convinced that I've spent enough time casting at a tier one level that I can now, you know, move that over into other games, start at the bottom and try that meteoric rise again whilst I plateau over here. And I'm gonna try. I'm doing my thing. I don't know if it's gonna work, but I would be crazy not to try that, right?
I suppose, yes, there is that perspective, which seems like is common for you. And then there's also the other perspective, which is, God, that sounds exhausting, which you've already brought up, right? So but if you're willing to take on that challenge, if that is where you're at, like that is a beautiful place to be, especially if you're also aware of the pitfalls that can happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously you're doing a great job. You did the Valorant game changers, what they were called, yep. Right? And that went very, very well. I listened in and...
What did you think? I know that's so
sucked.
On the spot.
I'm just going to say on this podcast. No, I'm just kidding.
All right, let me know. Tell me how you feel.
No, I thought it was very good. I was actually surprised by the amount of color that you were bringing. So I think you were casting with, not Veli.
Fancily.
Fancily. There you go. I was like, it's a big word. So I was surprised by the amount of analysis that was being brought. I didn't expect that, as I know that you had only been recently contracted to do Valorant. So... I thought it was great. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed listening to all the ladies and the commentating. I actually have some pretty strong opinions about overall Valorant commentating. We can talk about that after the podcast, though.
Cool. Let me know. I'll wait.
Regardless, I think that that's already a good sign. I mean, that seems to be like the whole meteoric. You say it so much better than I do. Progress. That you were talking about, but it can be difficult. It's like I've been trying to move into other games and see what I like doing, because StarCraft 2 has been, I definitely feel capped out in StarCraft 2. Hopefully maybe that'll change when it comes back to being in season, like, you know, lands. And it's really hard to judge anything right now. I don't know if you're in a similar place, but okay, yeah. It's so hard to judge anything.
Well, actually no.
Okay, all right.
I would say Siege because it changed into that new format right as COVID hit, I signed that contract last year, but I was like a contractor, right? And that's the worst place to be in as a freelancer. You're like, this might never continue. And then as a result of me being Australian, non-EU, they had to sign me as a full-time employee.
Oh.
This year. Wow. So, Colby, got it.
That's awesome. I was coming from more like, you know, like, yes, you're an individual e-sport, but just like, you know, if you don't like doing something right now, is it because you don't like the thing, or is it because like everything sucks around it? It's hard to answer.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I've been looking into other esports, and Valorant was interesting enough. I liked it enough that I was like, I'm going to get my feet wet in this one. You know, I don't expect to be where you are or where anyone is doing the main gigs, but I want to see what it's like. And I got to say, like, after trying it, it is exhausting. Like, it did the whole planning thing. You know, it's like, I'm going to do this week, this that week. I'm going to like gradually increase, not overburden myself. And I'm just like, all right, this is already like the expectations that I feel are coming at me from all different directions. When I started following the subreddit, following people on Twitter, it was like, this week I'm going to study this region. Don't have any expectations, man. And then I just get barraged with everything that's happening in the esport. And I'm like, I'm so far behind. I don't know what I'm doing. Yep. Like, how did you are you currently overcoming that? Do you feel like your background, especially in an FPS, is helping you out? Or are you equally dwarfed and just kind of power through it?
Honestly, my background in FPS has saved me when it comes to Valorant. There are so, just even simple terminology, the minutiae of fundamentals of casting, and that coming in and sounding like you know what you're saying, sometimes can save you. I'm not saying I'm bullshitting, because I definitely know the words that I'm saying, and I know that they absolutely have meaning, you know, jiggle peeking, this, that, pinch formation, so on and so forth. I can break down an FPS game. Most are very, especially bomb planting or diffuser planting ones, they are always going to be 9 times out of 10, the same kind of vibe. What makes it difficult in Valorant is that the retakes are where it happens, not the plants of the attackers. And I was like, how do I understand this game, which is not doing the logical thing, but it seems logical that you let them plant and then you use your abilities to retake, and the person with the most abilities left oftentimes win. And I'm like, people run through smokes, and I'm like, I don't know what's going on. So that was the uphill for me, was sounding like the words I was saying attached to the correct parts of the round so that I don't sound like an absolute idiot. And then when I leave that, I'm in, like, I've got people in my DMs going, what do you think of Astra? And I'm like, don't really know what to tell you right there. She's pretty hot and has stars, gorgeous. And I'm like, that is so dumb. Like, that is horrific. You can't say that. You've got to have some kind of depth to you. And I don't think I want to create myself as a personality in Valorant. I don't think I want that. If I have to move games, you know, completely one day, then absolutely I'm going to have to transfer that over somehow, some way. I think being FPS already, it won't be difficult. A lot of the Siege community plays Valorant, vice versa, etc. So I definitely think learning regions and their styles and their play styles has been easy. You watch a few VODs. I watched some of the Korean, I watched some of the North American, so on and so forth. There's a dominance of these compositions. There's not a dominance of that. Those are trends and stuff like that that I find easy to catch on to. Maybe it's just my study background. I do well with stats and graphs and numbers and whatever, so I can take it in easily. It's the round by round stuff where I'm just like, this is shocking. Like, I can't keep up. If I can't keep up, and like Van Silly's pointing out stuff like Astra Star is pulling in, and I'm like, how did you know that Astra Star was like doing its gravitational pull at that singular moment? I'm like, are you hearing things I'm not hearing? And I'm like, what is going on? And then he goes, well, on the mini map you could see that tripwire. And I was like, which team's tripwire is that? And I'm right up on my screen going, oh no, is that you know, the attacking team? Honestly, it's a nightmare to go from a game where I could close my eyes, use the sounds and know what's happening, to Valorant, where I'm like, oh, yep. And I'm like, I'm not seeming confident. I don't know what's going on. I'm trying to hybrid cast to make up for the fact that I don't know why that rage just did that thing. And oh, honestly, I'm getting anxious just thinking about it right now. Oh my goodness.
I did not get that impression. I mean, I didn't listen to all of it, so maybe I just caught like a really like good like 30 maybe. Minutes. But like the yeah, I didn't really get that impression, but that is kind of amazing. It's like that's exactly the description I would have any other attempt I've made at other game casting, where it's like, well, I know like the overarching stuff and like how to flow, mm-hmm. and like I can bring in the jokes and make someone feel comfortable, which is what mm-hmm. I've done in some of my casts for Valorant. But yeah. As far as like actually like realizing like what's going on, like every single detail, like I would be able to in StarCraft. I'd be able to tell yeah. you exactly what happened and the kill shot, you know, why the upgrades mattered and whatnot. Can't do it in Valorant. And that lack of confidence is just like absolutely killer. One of the big things I worked right. on for so many years was just being super confident, you know, doing the mm-hmm. excessive note taking that mm-hmm. a lot of the people in esports do, but actually in StarCraft is pretty damn rare. Not many of us do it. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to be able to use 1/20th of the notes to say 100% that was correct. I know that, mm-hmm. even though the 19 out of 20 other things I never use. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine. And you were in a pretty big stage too. I just feel like, I mean, I guess you embraced it at some point.
Yeah. I think at some point I had to admit to myself that if I was going to be a talent, especially full time, Six Invitational was not a good representation of, I think, where I am mentally now. I was like, this is my full time job now. And if this is what I do full time, I don't consider, even though I'm actually making more in content creation than I am in casting, that's because my charm came out in the game. Don't think I'm some whiz on Twitch that I'm not. I don't have the viewership like some of the big masses on there. But my charm came out in the game. I'm now making more on Twitch than I am casting, and I make a good amount casting. So I'm very lucky. But I don't even consider my Twitch to be anywhere near as like full-time or as important, no matter the financials it brings in, as I do my casting. And if you don't fake it till you make it, you won't get there. You will not get there. If you don't build a foundation of confidence, and people will say, well, if it's based off fake confidence, it's brittle, it's going to break or whatever. But if you don't put it there to begin with, you'll never know what it smells like. You'll never know what it tastes like. You'll never know what it feels like. So you have to put it there to begin with, to get your senses into how that looks, how that sounds, how you portray yourself as a result. And that's what I've started doing recently, even in content like this. Right now I'm sitting here and I'm going, if I was chilling in the back with a Red Bull popping with some other esports, like you and I were talking, do you think I'd talk with this much smack sometimes? Hell no. I've got a humble heart, I promise you. But when I am talking about being confident, I have to believe it. Mm. Otherwise, one day you're going to wake up in a ball of a mess going, I can't handle this pressure anymore. And you've got to put on all the armor. You've got to be strong enough to wear it. And there's other extra things like being a woman that you try not to think about, but are also in the back of your head as well. And it's heavy. You're wearing it heavy every day. So fake it till you make it is the best I can give people. It sounds ridiculous, but there is a lot of psychology behind it, I promise.
That's true. Yeah. I like that as one of the end notes of the show, actually. Like, it is kind of, like, that is what you're doing a lot of the time, you know? And yeah. Again, usually you kind of want to do it in some, like, really, like, you know, a YouTube video and fake, mm-hmm. you know, being super confident. But sometimes yeah. also the opportunity comes where it's like, you have a month to learn this game. Do you want to take it or mm-hmm. not? And it takes a lot of guts to say yes to that, I got to say. Very, very impressed.
I mean, if I don't do it and I don't know how it was going to turn out, like, it's what's that saying? If you don't ask, the answer is no. But if you do ask, the answer might be yes. I apply that same rationale to everything else I do in life. Everything. Should I go say hi to that person who I think might not like me or might not, you know, blah, blah, they're bigger or better than me? Mm. Well, if I don't do it, I've never tried. There's, you know, no net outcome. If I do it and I get denied, at least I know the answer, right? I've got to live that way. I have to. Otherwise, I'm not living life to the fullest. I know it's so cliche and cheesy. It really is. I think some of the things that come out of my damn mouth sometimes. but honestly, if you're sitting there, you go, I don't think I should do this. I don't think I should do that. I shouldn't talk to this person. I shouldn't do this. The answer is no. Yeah. The answer is 100% no if you think that way. So Valorant was the same. My mage and said, can you learn the game in a month? And I was like, if I say no, then I don't get the gig, then I don't know what the outcome could have been. But if I say yes, and I just kick my butt into gear for a month and I don't sleep, what could be the outcomes of it? And I've had 3 Valorant gigs in 3 months.
Damn, yeah. So what happens when you can say yes, but also do the work? She's another thing. So that's you've been able to come in with a lot of prep work, where I think there are going to be other examples of people kind of phoning it in when they get an opportunity. But that's for after. That's for an after party sometime in the future.
Yes, with alcohol that I never drink. People say, you must be a crazy partier. And I'm like, yes, but it only takes 2 drinks for me to get drunk. And I drink like maybe once every 6 months.
Oh, gotcha.
So I'm one of those people that's like, if you catch me at the after party, probably drunk in the first 20 minutes. So that's when you should ask all of your questions, because I will be as honest as possible. That is, I probably shouldn't have told everyone that, but open book.
Can't wait to meet. But we're going to finish actually on a Patreon question. So let's see. Nick asks, how important do you think streaming is to being a commentator? And does that importance change as one gets more established?
Mm-hmm. I hate to be that person that points this out. Great question. You don't build a brand for yourself. And unfortunately, a lot of that either comes through YouTube or Twitch. Let's be honest, the synonymous areas of building a brand as a talent and a content creator come through Twitch, YouTube, and maybe TikTok on the rise, and Instagram. There's other areas, but I would say Twitch and YouTube would be the massive ones. If you don't build yourself somewhere along the way, you're going to get left behind. And I will give you the greatest example. I love you, Steinhappers. You are my Dutch ex-duo. People still ask who he is in Twitch chat. Still. Now, if people in Twitch chat are still asking, then he doesn't have big enough brand to make a mainstay in the Rainbow Six at a tier 1 level. He's obviously not making enough impact with his casting to be memorable for the community retention that we're getting in our game currently, to the point where he wasn't offered 6 Invitational to begin with. Now, is there a direct correlation? My producer seems to think there is. And he's alluded to the fact that there is oftentimes numbers associated with who gets picked for what and who doesn't. And that sucks, because we like to think that our hard work is what gets us somewhere. And unfortunately, it's sometimes the hard work of diversifying yourself so much that your community is so big and full and valuable that sometimes it's better to go with that person because they can bring more overall than it is with poor Steinhappers, who great with the numbers, speaks like a weatherman on the analyst desk, but the other person could do it and has the dedicated audience and community to do it. So yes, long story short, I tell this to everyone as a player. I used to teach my players to stream because once you're done as a player, once you're done as a talent, once you're done as whatever you're doing, what do you got left in esports? A smile, a Reddit account with 13,000 karma? It ain't paying the bills.
Oh, that's a very strong opinion on that, yeah. I like it, though, because I think there are a lot of people who are in tier 1 esports, in the tier 1 position of casting them, and they don't have to do a stream, and I think that's totally fine. A lot of CSGO guys don't really bother streaming a whole lot, or they stream like Valheim or something, right? Yeah. For StarCraft, we have to do it because full-time commentary doesn't actually pay enough.
Yep.
But you're in that position where, like, if you wanted to stop streaming, you'd probably be okay for a while. But
yeah,
you have a strong opinion that you really shouldn't, that you should be constantly just like building a brand. I agree.
You don't have to be crazy about it. Like, you don't have to go like me working 7 days a week, you know, where you broadcast 4 days a week, stream 3 days a week, whatever. Like, you don't have to be that hardcore. I've kind of dug myself a hole by, you know, meeting the thresholds for a charm, getting a charm, and now I'm just like, I can't stop streaming to everyone because I gotta give this charm away and they're gonna buy it and do it and whatever. So it's mine. Then my merchandise came out. I'm telling you, I've dug a hole way too deep. I'm drowning. I need like a social media manager. If you speak French and you know how to do social media things, reach out to Jess Goat. We'll pay you a salary to do my things because I suck. Please. Not a joke, not a lie. But yeah, I truly do think if you want to stay, it's not getting yourself in. If you want to stay and have longevity, you've got to have more. and that comes behind a brand. And maybe in the older games where you are so ingrained into the community that your loss would be felt, I can understand that. That's your own brand. That's a brand. That's a different type of brand, but it's still a brand. People forget that. Whereas a newer game like Siege that comes out in 2015, and I'm not really ingrained in the community until 2017, 2018, I've been doing it 100% of the time since then, 100% of the time after my master's degree, essentially. I've been going full speed that entire time just to catch up in my branding. And that's just to be like base level where I think you should be as a talent or as a coach or as a player or whatever you want to be. So yeah, honestly, I don't know. Maybe other people will you know, comment different opinions and open my eyes. I am very open to be proven wrong. I like to see the other side of the spectrum. But yeah, you need to provide some pretty solid evidence to prove that talent can get by in the esports industry based off commentary alone, unless they were in more than two games. Unless they were a pansy, but she streams. Unless, I can't even think of a name. Cannot think of a name that doesn't already have a huge audience either on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Twitch, or somewhere else.
Right.
I can't. I can't tell you one, and I know many.
Yeah. It's, branding is actually like a topic that we could spend like a lot of time on. But whether you're intentionally doing it or not, like there are brands building. So I'm glad you mentioned that. There's people out there who don't think a day in their life about the word brands, but they have a brand.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And it's all, I feel like a lot of it's also like not just about like pushing an angle so that you're more cemented as that angle in someone's mind, like an analyst, you know, but it's also just like people just eventually kind of get used to people, as dumb as that sounds. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of being a commentator is just being there so often in front of people's faces that they don't have room to say like, oh, I don't know who that is, or they don't do enough stuff, so why do I care? You're just, you shove your face into their face so often. They're like, ah, I guess they're here. And they don't, and they, a lot of criticism stops after that. But yeah, like I said, we get a lot into that, but we do have to wrap up and not make this a 5-hour podcast. So yeah. Thank you. This is really a great podcast. Really enjoyed it. So where people can find you, you got the charm out, you're doing different games. Rainbow Six is still doing its league right now. So where are you at?
Jess Goat everywhere, only because of that woman from Perth who had Jess Goat on Instagram and forced me to have to buy it from her. Don't like you. Could have just given it to me. You weren't even using Instagram, girlfriend. Anyway, whatever. Take it back. I'm Jess Goat everywhere. Thanks to the girl in Perth who, you know, gave me that name finally. So you can find me everywhere, predominantly on Twitter and Twitch. So those are my, you know, massive. But once I do get a French/English speaking social media manager, I'll upload photos on Instagram too. I promise. I'm a human and take photos, I guess.
The more you say that, the more I'm really convinced. I am human.
I'm human. Guys, I'm a human. I promise. Everyone's good at taking photos and I suck. And I'm just like, how do I do it? And I don't post anything on Instagram as a result. And that's like Instagram's entire purpose is like, you post a photo and photos tell a story. And I'm like, I'm just sitting in front of my computer. Like, I don't care.
Yeah. I take pictures of my cats. I imagine a lot of the guys in Twitch chat asking me for my Instagram, imagine a certain type of Instagram. And I'm like, it's not that type of pussy. Anyways.
That is a brilliant way to end this because that is totally the type of thing I would say, especially if I had a drink. So
nice. Well, hopefully we'll hang out one day, potentially even soon. Things seem to be clearing up a little bit, so I'm looking forward to it, and continue success with you. Definitely wish you the best, as well as Rainbow Six. I think that's a really cool esport, and I hope everyone enjoyed it out there. I think we talked a lot about a lot of cool things, a lot of interesting things, serious things. So if you enjoyed it, give a follow to the podcast and give a follow to the wonderful guest, Jess Goat. Thanks for watching, guys, and I'll see you in 2 weeks for episode 35. Bye. Thanks everyone for listening to Caster Calls with Zombie Grub. Hope you enjoyed the interview with Jess Goetz. I think we actually have like baseline some different personality types, but nonetheless, I think we got along really well, had some really fun moments, and it was a interesting kind of new perspective of like everyone, you know, always talks about how hard you have to work in esports as a freelance gig, but the way that she had structured it and had such high expectations for it, I think was a little bit different from, you know, more of the creative loosey-gooseys that you might find in the esports world. So I think this was still a fresh perspective, and just in general, she's a really awesome person. I came to learn listening to her talk about her life and whatnot. So hope you guys enjoyed it as well. Thank you to the supporters over on Patreon, patreon.com/zombiegrub, Nick, Vini, and Steven. Thank you guys for going above and beyond. On that note about the Patreon, things will be kind of changing. One of the first things that I want to do is actually stop using Zencastr. Some of you might have noticed that this audio quality of this episode was wanting on Jess Goetz's side. Basically, Zencastr is a program that allows you to get the audio directly from a computer, so the internet doesn't drop out, which is very useful if I'm talking to like especially someone in Australia. So they basically are, you know, as if they're recording on their own side, like using Audacity or something, but it has to upload and it breaks more often than I would like, which is not super frequently, but obviously an hour and a half of an interview being basically borked and not really recoverable audio quality wise makes me feel very sad. So I'm going to be looking at other alternatives, which might include something that I have to pay monthly for, but it's something that I would like to do. So that's one of the first things that I'm doing. But then the Patreon also is going to be probably on hiatus for about a month, as well as the podcast will be too. Now, this is not me canceling the podcast, but rather just kind of reconfiguring it and allowing some things to catch up. So episode 35 will be a freebie, no charge, and it'll be just me discussing some of the things that I've learned over the past year and a half doing this podcast, as well as maybe, an episode about me, I suppose, kind of. And then no charge there. The Patreon will be, I think, shut down is how it works. I'm not sure, but basically I've wanted to change the Patreon for a while now, but wanted to wait as long as I thought was feasible, because I didn't want to cut the support out from under me. But in order to like change tiers on Patreon or change it to a monthly system as opposed to a per episode system, it does require it to be like basically shut down. So yeah, that'll be updated as we go along, but those are my plans. So I'm going to make the tiers cheaper, and I'm going to make it a monthly Patreon as well, so people who just want to support me overall, which I think a lot of people are actually doing, can do so. But of course, if you want the benefits of the podcast perks, you'll also get that, and actually for cheaper. And because I've been pretty darn good about actually having a episode every other week, I am less concerned about stealing from you guys, from not releasing a podcast episode and then being like, well, thanks for your money anyways, like see you next month. So that's one of the reasons that I wanted to do it per episode. But I actually think that from what I've seen, actually looking into more Patreons and podcasts, like the per episode thing is more awkward than it's worth. So that's kind of priority number one. It also is going to help me catch up with the chapter markers. So I have someone actually making the chapters that you see on like YouTube for my podcasts, and that is up from episode 1 through 20 right now. And then I'll finish up until, you know, episode 35. And then I'll look into having chapters prepared for release day, which would be the obvious, best case scenario, but we'll see what happens there. Now, with all that said, I do want to reiterate that this is not me canceling the podcast. I still find a lot of benefit in it, even though it costs a fair amount and can be a fair amount of work. It is something that I am truly passionate about and would do even if I had very little support, just because I really like it. And also, I think the actually connections that I'm making are, they're end up being quite valuable, not just in a business sense, but also just like I'm really enjoying meeting new people in the industry and hopefully one day actually getting to meet them in person. Kind of awkward that this started basically at the start of the COVID years, but soon, right? Yeah, okay. So just wanted to reiterate that. It's not ending, but it is going to be revamped, and hopefully in a way that is actually an improvement for everyone out there. So please, you know, consider continuing to support me as I continue streaming and doing YouTube work and doing this podcast. It's just going to be about a month of break, and then we'll be right back on it, I guess, with episode 36 being the continuation of interviewing other guests. So as always, thank you for listening to the podcast, whichever one you have listened to, this one, other ones, so on and so forth. And I hope to see you again here soon as I head into a new stage of Caster Calls a Zombie Grub. See you there.